Welcome to The Late Set from WRTI. I'm Josh Jackson.
I'm Nate Chenin.
Nate, it's been super busy. We're at the tail end of Women's History Month. We've been celebrating that all throughout this month at WRTI and on the cusp of Jazz Appreciation Month and here in Philadelphia, Philly Jazz Month, where we will have a number of activities happening. But we're always busy.
You know, T.S. Eliot said April is the cruelest month. I think we have to modify that and say April is the coolest month.
It is.
How about that?
And Jazz Appreciation Month and the International Jazz Day this year happens in Chicago, which was the early stomping grounds of our guest, Miss Tamika Reed.
Tamika, she is indeed a product of Chicago. She has played with a ton of people from that city. Her generation and elders. She has been a productive member of the Association for the Advancement of Creative Musicians, but she's also collaborated really widely beyond that base. And in fact, one of the reasons that I was so keen on bringing her into our podcast feed around this time is that she appears on two of my favorite albums of 2026 so far, the first of which is Dream Archives, by Craig Taborn, also with Chess Smith on drums and percussion. That's on ECM Records. And then Tamika's own album.
With lots of exclamation marks.
Lowercase and exclamation marks. Dance.
Yes.
Skip.
Yes.
Hop.
Yes.
And this is by the Tamika Reed Quartet, which is a wonderful working band. You know, she's been very, very busy. She's been touring off in Japan, doing all kinds of stuff, but we managed to get her down to Philly. I picked her up at 30th Street Station and brought her over to our studio. And we had a really fun and illuminating conversation about the cello, about her philosophy of collaboration, about a whole bunch of stuff. I really, really enjoyed this conversation.
Let's check it out.
Tamika Reed, welcome to The Late Set.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for coming down to Philly, joining us in the studio here at WRTI. This is something I've wanted to do for a while, especially in light of how much amazing music you've been a part of already in 2026, mm-hmm. including probably what I think is the first great, truly great album of this year, which is Craig Taborn's Dream Archives mm-hmm. with you and Chess Smith. And then now your quartet release, Dance, Skip, Hop. And so I want to start with that title, mm-hmm. which I love. Can you tell us about what led you to, it's an unusual title for a jazz record today or for a creative music album today, mm-hmm. but it totally fits with the music. So what led you to that?
I thought about Josh Berman's record, A Dance and a Hop, and I just loved that. Mm-hmm. So I wrote him and I was like, hey, you know, at first I looked to see if he had a track that was called that, because I was like, maybe I could just ask him if I could borrow that title, because I felt like it fit the energy that I was trying to express. And so I asked him if he'd help with the titling something, but then I was like, well, can I just use A Dance and a Hop? And I was like, no. As more and more I thought about it, I changed it to Dance, Skip, Hop, and then it's kind of a nod to him and just to Chicago in general, because I feel like that's really where I grew up musically. And so I like having lots of connections like that. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that's how that really came about.
Do you feel like with left of center or progressive improvised music, there's often not enough emphasis on that kind of frolicsome energy or just joy?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I feel like it can be so serious, which it is, it's still serious, but I don't know. I guess maybe as I'm just getting older, I feel more comfortable, I guess, sharing all sides of myself. I am a serious person, or I do take things seriously, but I think I have a really silly side. I'm goofy that I think people don't necessarily know, or even with my last record, 3+3, it's like, I'm putting in more of the free improv stuff that I do with the written material. It's, you know, I've had people say to me, oh, you write very tune-based music, but when you improvise yourself, it's very free. And it's like, I want to I still want to marry both of those worlds more mm-hmm. in what I do, because I do like playing tune stuff, but I also really love free improvisation where I'm just dealing with sound. And yeah, and I love to dance. I used to love going dancing when I was younger, and I want to just show, I guess, all sides of myself in the music that I write.
The word that always comes to mind when I think, especially about the opening track and the title track on this album, is springy. Mm. Like, you know, it just feels, both in terms of the season that we're hopefully soon about to experience, and then also the idea of like a coiled spring, like almost Jack in the Box kind of, because your instrument, the way you're playing the instrument on that track, along with bass, drums, and guitar, like, I feel like everyone is just, there's just a bounciness. The yes. rhythmic energy is really effervescent. And yeah, every time I think about it, I'm like, springy. It's yeah. just sproying.
No, that's great. I mean, I think a lot of times still people think with the cello, like, it's such a beautiful instrument. I know I'm biased, but you have these like long, sustained sounds. And I think I was also thinking about that too, like to be something that is lighter, more bouncy, or making the instrument dance in this in a jazz context. So I was thinking about that too. So I wanted to write something that would be engaging and fun for us to play if we go on a tour, because you have to play that same music, you right. know, night after night. So I wanted to write some interesting, they actually all started out titled Vehicle. It was like Vehicle 8, Vehicle 1, Vehicle 8, Vehicle 6, 2. I had that before I had titles.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you did eventually furnish them with more evocative titles, because yeah. the numerical strategy doesn't quite fit mm-hmm. these themes. You mentioned these musicians, and the four of you have been a unit for a really long time. Mm-hmm. Like, I know I saw you at a Winter Jazz Fest, and I feel like it was probably like 12 years ago or something. How far back does the yeah. lineup go?
I can't remember when that Winter Jazz Festival was, but yeah, we are 12 years. We started in February of 2014, and then I think that first record came out in 2015.
Okay.
I think maybe we did Winter Jazz maybe around, it was before the pandemic, so yeah, maybe 2017 or something like mm-hmm. that. But yeah, I think ever since high school, actually, I wanted a band. I wanted to be in a band or have my own band. You know, I didn't know what was possible or when that would happen, but I like doing new projects, but I also love being in a band and the sound that develops after being together and touring together and growing together. I really love that. So I'm really honored that we're still playing together after 12 years.
Does it feel different now?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I knew Mary and Toma from playing in Mike Reed's Living by Lanterns. And I knew Jason just from the Chicago scene, but we hadn't really played in the same projects before. So I've definitely got to know them more than just as musicians. I feel like we're a little family, you know. I think we've all met each other's parents, which I don't know how usual, how normal that is, but that's been really nice. And yeah, I think we've just gotten to spend some really quality time. Like we've gone to Japan in 2024 and in 2025, and I call them a tourcation. So since it was the first time in 24 for me to go to Japan, it's like I didn't want to do one of those tours where you're like tour and then go home. I would like to experience the place, and we experience together and go to some tourist attractions together. A lot of times on tour you don't have that ability. It's just like you see the airport, you see the venue and the hotel, and then it's another day. You do the same thing over and over again. And so I think having that time is, it's not rehearsing, but it's kind of rehearsing. You know, right, it impacts right. the music to have these meals together, to just have these experiences together. And it comes out in the music when we're playing live. Like you might be reflecting on something beautiful that you saw in, I don't know, Kyoto, or when we went jean shopping in Kojima. You know, you don't know where those inspirations can come from. So yeah, I think we've grown as a band. I feel like I've grown as a band leader. You know, it was definitely my first project where I was leading, and I think they've seen me grow as a leader and as a composer and a player. And so yeah, I'm really grateful for that. Thank you.
I think of this instrument in your hands as the ultimate, like, flexible machine, you know? And this is true when I've seen you with the Art Ensemble of Chicago, and it's true when I've seen your quartet. And then most recently, last fall, I was at Jazz Fest Berlin and saw you with Angelika Nissier's Dragon Trio. Mm-hmm. And the way that you function in a group like that, you are a contrapuntal melodic voice. You're also a chordal instrument. You're also the bass. And so it's really like you can do kind of anything in the context. You can be a pure rhythm instrument as well. So I'd love to hear you talk about that flexibility and the extent to which you've developed that as part of your voice.
Yeah, I mean, it's wild because I hadn't even heard a cello before. I started playing it like in fourth grade. I was just like, all the girls are picking flute and violin. I want to play the cello because maybe kids will think I'm cool. I don't know.
And this was in Silver Spring, Maryland?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I went to this, my mom put me in this French immersion school in Silver Spring. But yeah, I think that's what's so beautiful and amazing about the instrument. Yeah, like you said, it has all, it can do, it's so versatile. You know, you can do all these different things. And I had a mentor, I guess he became my mentor, and actually my play dad, I call him. His name is Dr. Saez Kamaluddin. But first he would encourage me if there were flyers, and I went to University of Maryland College Park, and sometimes on the bulletin board there'd be flyers for like cellists and rock bands or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh man, like I said, I always want to play in a band. I came to studying cello to be professional kind of late. So I was like, I need to focus on playing these concertos or sonatas or this orchestra music or whatever. So I didn't really allow myself to investigate that. But then around my senior year of college, and I did about 5 years because I was, you know, kind of behind, he's like, hey, and he just handed me this like Rufus Reed bassline book, and he would play he played the flute. I was reading these basslines, but learning also bassline construction by doing that. So that's how I started, quote unquote, I guess, walking, but I was really reading these lines. And then when I moved to Chicago and started playing with Nicole Mitchell's Black Earth Ensemble, you know, there was already a bass in the band. And so then I was like, oh, what do I do here? And then it was like, oh, she had these like kind of comp figures I could do. But oftentimes people would have me playing these projects, but they wouldn't tell me what to do,
right.
Which in a way, I mean, looking back on it, I mean, I think it was actually a gift, but at the time it was really frustrating because it's like, I've been in this classical world where everything's on the page and, you know, now you're asking me to like come up with something and I don't know what I'm doing and trying to listen. There weren't a ton of local players. There was Fred Lumbercombe that I knew about, but there weren't a ton of local players to figure out what do I do here, you know?
Right.
And then it was like, oh, you're doing great, or you'll hear it. But then some people are like, oh, well, you don't know any jazz language. And so I'm just like, I'm trying to figure this out. So people kind of just let me be on my own with that. And then, yeah, when there was like a bass player, I wouldn't know what to do, but they're like, oh, walk with them. But I was like, I'd never heard that before. So I was like, that's weird. How do I do that? Now, looking back on it, I can think, okay, I was thinking about, I wouldn't have used that word at the time, but kind of like orchestration of like, mm-hmm. okay, well, the bass is in this register. If I want to be heard, what do I play so that I'm not in the range of the bass, but then, okay, and also not in the range of the bass drum. How can I complement with these chordal figures or comp figures to add some kind of interest? Nikki would ask me to play the melody or something like that. So I was getting just thrown into all these situations. But then it was cool because, and then people were asking me to do gigs in Chicago, like, oh, can you, I don't know. They were just, sometimes I feel like people just, they're like, oh, cello is cool. And they just want the cello in the band, but they don't actually know what they want the cello to do.
Or maybe it was a testament to like, they heard whatever you were contributing to some other project and they were like, that sounds good.
Yeah, I guess so. But like I said, early on, it was a little bit frustrating because I was like, I don't know, am I doing this right? I think just because of classical music, you know, you have your teacher, you have someone that's like, this is right or this is wrong. And so you're not getting that kind of...
Well, and there's also, you know, a real dearth of recorded precedent for improvising cello. It's not like you're learning to be an alto saxophonist in a band. Mm-hmm. You've got miles and miles and miles of stuff to listen to.
Well, that's when I did start trying to transcribing. So mm-hmm. I had what I was calling like my bass cellist. So that was like the bass players that picked up the cello, but they often tuned it like right. a bass. And then they're like playing all these amazing lines, like Oscar Pettiford, Doug Watkins. I would transcribe some of that. And then I would listen to Ron Carter play with Eric Dolphy. Mm-hmm. And then I learned about Abdul Wadud, who's definitely my dude.
Yeah, yeah.
No, but he's like definitely one of my favorites, and Deirdre Murray as well. Yeah. And then, yeah, I learned about Akua Dixon. Then I just started digging and Eileen Folsom and then trying to find any cello players, honestly, and like just Black cello players in music. Even when I did classical music, I learned about Kermit Moore because I was like, man, are there any Black classical cello players out there that have recorded something? But yeah, I just started checking out Chico Hamilton's band. He had cello players.
Red Cats. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the other one was Kalo Scott, who mm-hmm. I really wish, if anybody out there has information on him, I know he passed, but I would love to know more about Kalo Scott. But yeah, I did start transcribing other, particularly the bass cello players, because I feel like that's the cool thing about the cello. There isn't this like huge like legacy, like or not legacy. There is a legacy, but there's not, like you said, the alto sax or drums. There's just like this deep thing that you feel like you have the weight of this history yeah. on. Where I feel like as a cello player, you don't have that, and it's
kind a more niche legacy.
Yeah,
you know, it's like
yeah.
you have to kind of find it.
Yeah, yeah.
There was a period. In, I want to say it was in the early 2000s when Eric Friedlander was working a lot in New York with this band he called the Broken Arm Trio. Mm. You familiar with this?
Not that trio, no.
This was his nod to Oscar Pettiford because the story goes that
Oh, yeah.
In 1949, mm-hmm. Oscar broke his arm playing baseball with yeah. the Woody Herman band.
Yeah.
And that's when he
picked up the cello
and started really exploring the yeah. possibilities.
And then so, I think he named his kids like Celeste and Chelina.
Yeah.
And,
yeah. About that. But so Eric was inspired by Eric, who is a cellist,
yes.
but he was very specifically looking to that Oscar Pettiford legacy. And so it was a band in which Eric, I don't think he did any bowing. I think it was like no arco at all. He was just like yeah. 100% pizzicato doing mm-hmm. the sort of Pettiford thing. I had not explored that corner of the Pettiford discography that deeply. Mm-hmm. And then Eric's project nudged me in that direction, which was cool.
Yeah, that's awesome.
But I want to talk for a minute about Abdul Wadud. Spiritual connection that you have to him is, I think, really strong. And his work with Julius Hemphill and then also on his own, especially the solo album, is just by myself.
Yeah.
These are revelatory contributions. And he was kind of slept on in a certain way. Mm-hmm. Can we talk about how powerful it was to discover him and what you, like where you feel the affinity with him?
Yeah, I think the first recording I feel I heard was the duo record, Live in New York or something like that. I see the cover of, it's like Hemphill's on one side and Abdul's on the other. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I just remember hearing this and being like, wow, I don't know how he's doing this but I was definitely interested in figuring it out. And I think what I really loved about him was his sound. He was a really strong cello player. Like, you know, he played classical music clearly, as most cellists, I guess we all start, most of us start that way. And yeah, he also had just such a deep groove and feel and pocket, you know, you hear that like on Dogon AD, of course.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just really inspiring. And I was just like, man, I want to have that level of creativity someday. You know, I want to have that feel. And just the fact that he seemed so courageous, especially when going up into the upper register, because sometimes it's so scary and you worry about playing in tune, and it's just, he's just going for it.
Mm-hmm.
when you think about like, oh, what do I want to do, or what could I want to aspire to? I was like, that was definitely his approach, was definitely something that I'm like, man, I would love to have that much ability on my instrument. There's another word I'm looking for, but just he just sounded so natural and so mm-hmm. comfortable, and just his approach I just thought was really amazing.
When the conversation so often involves toggling between or bridging classical and jazz languages, you look to Abdul Wadud and you're like, there's no bridging here. Like he's like carving out his own space.
Exactly.
You know, it's like there's
capacity. That's the word.
Yeah.
I
yeah.
For. Yeah.
He's definitely capacious. Yeah. I'm glad that you mentioned the sense of groove too. Just, he feels so grounded.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely hear that in your music as well. You know, whatever's happening, even when you're getting fully abstracted with your improvisation, it always feels very stable.
Thank you.
There's an incredible solo that you play on this new album, and I think it's on For CC, For CC and CC.
Mm-hmm.
Just a very expressive solo where, you know, it sort of goes into this space where you're really, really high up on the bridge.
Oh, maybe that's Under the Aurora Sky. Am I arco in that one?
I was thinking of like a pizzicato.
Oh, pizzicato.
But it was just like very, very like...
Oh, okay.
But we can talk about the other track, too.
No.
I wanted to ask, though, about the dedication there.
For sure. So, during the pandemic, a lot of my friends know I became my grandmother's caregiver. We rented an RV and drove all the way to Wyoming to get her.
Oh, wow.
Her sister is Cece, so her name is Sarah Green, but I know her as Aunt Cece. And so it turned out that my grandmother had Alzheimer's, and it was just a really beautifully challenging time, because I was really grateful in some ways that I had the time because of the pandemic that I could take care of her, because I've been touring so much. But it was just also really hard because, you know, in the pandemic, it's like I couldn't go to the hospital with her. She needed all kinds of help, and it was a lot. So Aunt Cece was helpful, and just like, you know, whenever I was crying or dealing with like, I can't, you know, we gotta, you know, every time she needed to go to the hospital, I had to like call the ambulance to like bring her down the three flights of stairs. And I live on a one-story street, and it was just like, it just was so much. But she was always there for me to talk, just as guidance.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just so grateful to her for that. And I know she was grateful for me taking care of her sister. She tells me that. And so she is C-E-C-E.
Mm-hmm.
And C-C was a gentleman named Clarence James. Clarence Thomas. What?
No. Not that Clarence.
No. Clarence James, or CC James. And he would always, I met him at the Velvet Lounge, Fred Anderson's Velvet Lounge in Chicago. And he just always went to the shows, and he was just always super supportive of me. And I would go to his house in Hyde Park, and he had all these CDs, and he just put on some music for me. It's like, you should check this out. Check this out. Because again, I was trying to figure out, what am I doing, or what is this music that I'm involved with? Because prior to that, I had just mostly listened to straight ahead jazz. So he was just having me watch Cecil Taylor videos and check out this Henry Threadneedle recording, and I don't know, just a whole host of different stuff. And he actually transitioned in April of 2018. And I'm just so grateful to have had him as a, I don't know if he was like a mentor, but he was one of those, I don't know, you encounter those people that they're just like so important to the community, but they're not a musician. They're just I don't even want to call them a super fan. They're just like supportive. It's just like, that's what
they're part of the glue
exactly.
the whole scene. Yeah,
exactly. And so I feel like I'm often someone that likes to show my gratitude to people or places or things. Even when I was thinking about titling this tune and thinking about my aunt as well, because my grandmother actually transitioned in, April of 2023. Yeah, I was like, wow, Cece. So Clarence, he did pass, But then like a year later, I got another CC in my life. Mm. I don't know.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's that dedication. Just like, wow, like the same kind of spirit is still with me, even though Clarence is gone. Yeah, but he was a very special individual.
Talk about the other great album that you're on in the beginning of this year, which is Craig Taborn's Dream Archive. You and Craig go way back, and he is another one of my favorite musicians. And this group, I don't know. It's very special. And so this is with him on piano, you on cello, and Chess Smith on drums and percussion. And the sensitivity among the three of you, moment to moment, and then also as a larger arc, it's just really next level. So can you speak to that ensemble and those relationships? What has that been like for you?
Yeah, I have to say that is one of my favorite projects that I do as a side person. I don't know. Craig is just very, I mean, he's definitely, I feel like I'm a fangirl. Like, even though I play in the band, like, he's definitely one of my favorite musicians as well. I think he's, the breath that you hear in his playing, I mean, you just hear everything. You hear his love of dance, house, techno, Detroit sound. You hear jazz, you hear rock, you hear everything. And it's another group that has, I think we have a great time talking about music. I mean, it's pretty wild. All the influences of the music that we talk about when we're on tour. It's funny.
What's the most surprising reference?
I don't know, like Pantera? I don't know.
It's just, that sounds about right.
Yeah, it's just like something like, what? But yeah, I think I love touring with that band. I love our live shows. Mm-hmm. I think we really, and what's so, it kind of reminds me of how I imagined the Art Ensemble was, and that it's different. Like, I hear so many people when they see the Art Ensemble, like in the earlier iteration, or like 70s, 80s, like every time the show was so different. Maybe yeah. They always ended with Odwalla or something, but every show was so different. And I feel that with this band.
I do want to create a moment to acknowledge that you had at least a couple of like really heavy figures who mentored you on the bandstand. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of Roscoe Mitchell and Anthony Braxton. Mm-hmm. And these are two fiercely original thinkers and also really generous and encouraging band leaders. I wonder what you would want to say about their influence and how it still lives in your own projects. Like, what has that meant to you?
It's definitely meant a lot to play with these two giants in the music. I'll say that they're two, we know who they are, but I feel like there's still a lot of people, a lot of schools that don't talk about their music, their legacy, their contributions, which I just think is a shame. So I do try to mention their names wherever I go, especially if I'm in a educational setting. Mm-hmm. But I think things that stick with me are just phrases they would say, or sometimes I'll be in a moment and I just hear Anthony going, hooray, you know, or, you know, Roscoe's silence is golden. Mm. I feel like there's lots of, sometimes when I'm doing like leading an improv workshop, I hear Roscoe saying, ready, set, go. You know, so I think a lot of those type of phrases come to my head. And also, I feel like in the same way, they didn't tell me what to do either. Or they don't tell you what to do exactly. Like with Anthony, I feel like he offers you like a palette of colors. And I feel like Roscoe definitely stressed listening and space. Yeah, pacing of not, because sometimes we do these art ensemble gigs and it's like, oh my gosh, like you want to like, that's when he would say silence is golden, but you'd want to get in there because it's like it's moving along. That's what he says. That's what I take a lot is take your time. I think about that a lot. He says, take your time. Because I know for me, it's like I like to do so many things and sometimes I have to remember, calm down, Tamika, like take your time. But yeah, we'll be in an art ensemble gig and you want to get in there and like do some, make something happening, but it's like something is happening and like to be patient and to take your time and just be fully present and think about everything that you are about to contribute to the setting. Yeah, that's something I feel like I definitely learned from him. Or even though, even in the moment, I still think it's through reflection actually of my time that I feel like I'm able to really understand those ideas. Or like, you know, he would be, he would say, you know, don't follow, you know.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking like, what does that exactly mean? And then, you know, I've been in other improvisatory situations, like with students, for example. And then I'm like, oh, you're, I was like, oh, yeah. That really hit home of what that means to like not follow. And yeah, they just had such compatible ideas about improvisation, even though they were very different. They're very different musicians and composers. But sometimes I think about Braxton's example of, okay, we're in two different practice rooms and you're playing your piece and I'm playing my piece and somehow it's fitting together. And you're just like, what? But but it makes sense. You know, once you're, I don't know, once you get into that headspace, it makes sense. How are you going to contribute to this musical happening, you know?
WRTI is especially committed to music education, and I don't think we've ever talked about that, but you established, what's the name of the organization in Chicago, the String?
Oh, the Chicago Jazz String Summit?
Yes. Can you talk about that a bit?
I founded it in 2013, and basically it's a three-day event that highlights innovative string players across the spectrum of improvisation. And yeah, I wanted there to, like when I was looking at string festivals just in the US, it's like a lot of things veered toward like bluegrass or fiddling or that type of thing, which I think is wonderful. But I was like, where is the space for us folks that are a little bit left of center and maybe that do some straight ahead stuff too? And so also at the time in Chicago, I felt like there was like the trumpet summit and the piano summit and the drum summit and the tenor saxophone summit and the out, you know, like, I'm like, where's the love for the string players?
Yeah.
And so that's when I was like, let's do this. And so, yeah, we did it in 2013 and then I had to stop for 2014-15, but since 16, we've had it every year. And it's been really, we also have, we honor someone like an innovative string player in the music. So we've honored Abdul Wadud. He actually came in 2016. We've honored Akua Dixon, Deirdre Murray, Stuff Smith, Leroy Jenkins. Also to bring attention to this legacy in string improvisation that does exist. And yeah, it's been a really beautiful event. We have Friday and Saturday nights, we have three sets each night. And I try to make sure that there's some Chicago or regional representation each year. And yeah, everyone, the string band leaders are invited to stay the whole time so that they can support each other, learn about each other, hear each other. And then on that final day, usually at the Hungry Brain, we have a jam session. So all the string players that are able to stay, we draw numbers out of a hat and we just play something together in front of an audience. And usually everyone leaves with good feeling and if they didn't know about each other, they know about each other then. And it's really awesome. But it's definitely a labor of love. Like,
yeah.
If there are any people out there that want to donate, please, I would love it. but the festival supports violin, viola, and cello specifically. Because I know some people are like, what? No guitar, no bass. But I'm mm-hmm. like, they've typically, you know, they get space actually. And I still want to. Well, until you can name me, like, without blinking an eye, five improvising violists, I want to make sure that there's a space for improvising violists that write their own original music to be able to present their own work. Also, you know, sometimes you hear festivals like, well, you know, I don't know any string player. I'm like, here you go.
Yeah.
You can look at old, you know, flyers of all these amazing musicians. Eric Friedlander has played, Akua Dixon's played, Hank Roberts has played, Mark Feldman, Mary Oliver. We've had some really great people play at this festival over the years. And I just hope it can continue.
Excellent. Yeah, I hope so too. And I love that you've carved out and held this space for that. Mm-hmm. And it brings us back to dance. Am I getting the order right? Dance, skip, hop.
Mm-hmm.
Because among other things, this is a string band.
Yeah.
Album. Like, this quartet is, you could also call it like the Tamika Reid String Ensemble, string band, you know, because Mary and Jason mm-hmm. and you are all engaged in that.
Yeah.
Toma is the, you know, he's like the honorary.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny because I didn't necessarily think about having a string ensemble, but I knew I wanted a, because originally it was a trio. Mm-hmm. I had a trio. It was me, Joshua Abramson, Matt Schneider, who goes by Fred Schneider now. But yeah, I didn't necessarily think of string band per se, but I didn't want to have piano, partly because of the amp situation. I was like, this amp is heavy. I didn't know if I wanted drums. I was like, if we're just a trio, we can just have some overhead mics. We don't have to worry about amps. I was really, and then also I wanted to like challenge myself with my own sense of rhythm and groove and how can we do that without having the drums. But then when I did want to make the quartet, then I was like, actually, I do really want drums. And so that's how, I guess, Toma is the honorary person.
Well, it creates a, there's so much range in the sonic density of the group because with those three stringed instruments, depending on what's happening with the orchestration, sometimes it's very, there's a lot of openness. And then sometimes it gets very dense and busy and mm-hmm. bristly. But it's really awesome to have that kind of adaptability within the sound of the group.
Mm-hmm.
It's a fantastic album.
Thank you.
Congratulations on it and also on Dream Archives. I cannot wait for my chance to see both of these ensembles, hopefully soon. Mm. And I just, you know, continue to look forward to what you have going on. So thanks again.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for having me.
Tamika Reid with Nate Chenin here on The Late Set. Man, Nate, I got to tell you, great to hear her talk about one of my favorite jazz cellists or musicians in the creative space, Abdul Wadud.
Yeah, it's a deep connection. She's not the only person I've heard say this. When she encountered his music, it was like a light bulb went off. It was just like, this is for me.
Yeah, and she's really community-minded. I love what she's doing for the string community.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, she's an organizer.
Yeah.
It's funny, you know, it just kind of worked out this way, but I so enjoyed this interview that I had to connect with her again. So at the Big Ears Festival, I had her on a panel along with Chris Thiele, the mandolinist. And this was a panel that was under the auspices of the MacArthur Foundation. Get a couple of geniuses together and continue the conversation. So fun to connect with her, and I know that there's always something good cooking in her world, you know? And I was happy to have her here in the building, hopefully not for the last time.
Well, this is a connection between not two geniuses called The Late Set.
There you go.
Josh Jackson and Nate Chenin. And it's also time for This I Dig.
That's right.
Thank you.
What have you been digging, Josh?
I'm going to surprise you, I think. I have an album that I'm putting on my short list for one of the best albums this year.
Wow.
And I don't think you've heard it.
Okay.
That's even more surprising, but maybe you have. Tomorrow's Yesterday. Do you know this record?
I've heard of this record, but I don't think I know it.
This is from the Norwegian singer Karen Krog.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, yeah. I know this record.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
All right. You cannot stump Nate for the record.
I reviewed Karen Krog at Joe's Pub once.
Did you really?
Yeah, yeah.
I have a great story with her, too. On one of the years that I went to Jazz Ahead, they flew me into Hamburg, and then I had a car waiting for me to take me to Bremen, and I was in the car with Karen Krog.
Wow.
So I got to hang with her in this space on the Autobahn going to Bremen.
Yeah.
And literally just pick her brain as much as possible. I love her, by the way.
She's super great.
She's super hip from the moment she did her very first record, By Myself, and all the stuff she did with Steve Swallow and those guys. And this record, Tomorrow's Yesterday's, is a beautiful record. I like it. It's a good vinyl album because on one side, it's her in a trio with her partner, John Sermon, mm-hmm. on saxophone and bass clarinet. And also this young guitarist, Rob Luft, who's been playing with Sermon. This is a young man who is really somebody to listen to. So it's mostly standards. She's approaching 90 years old now.
Yeah.
I think she's 88, although you shouldn't reveal a lady's age. But anyway, she does a wonderful job on this record. And on the second side is pianist Erlend Setevoll and Rob Waring on vibes. So it's like two trios, mm-hmm. Including her voice. Just a beautiful record. And it really, I don't know if it hit me in a particular moment, but there's something really special about this record.
Today is yesterday's tomorrow. We don't need a day of sorrow.
So I'm going with something that is hot off the presses.
Okay.
And I also am coming off of the high of witnessing this in person at Big Ears. But there is an album by Harriet Tubman with Georgia Ann Muldrow.
Oh, man.
It is called Electrical Field of Love.
Okay. Electrical being the important word here with that group.
Yes, exactly. And if you are familiar with either of these entities, and I hope you are, this pairing will, just hearing about it should send like a charge up your spine.
Yeah.
Everyone is just in such amazing form. Harriet Tubman is a band like no other, really.
Yeah.
Brandon
Dark
Ross,
mysticism.
Melvin Gibbs. I mean, it is some weird, like deep, gluey kind of Dark Magus stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? Georgia Ann Muldrow she's like a prophet of some kind. And so this album it just has me in its pull endlessly. I haven't figured it out, which I love.
That is good.
It's so mysterious and beautiful and scary and inspiring. There's just a lot in there. It's a thick stew. So it's just out. And I also want to shout out Pi Recordings, which released this album and is presently celebrating its 25th anniversary as a label. When I think back on this century of music, if we didn't have Pi Recordings, man, we would all be a lot poorer for it.
We'd miss a few great records.
A lot of great records. So I want to shout out our friends, Seth Rosner and Yulin Wang.
Yeah.
What a great legacy. And there's a lot more coming. So
25 years and going.
There we go.
I can't wait to hear that, by the way.
The Late Set is a production of WRTI and made possible by WRTI members. You like this podcast, right? Leave us a rating on the podcast platform of your choice. Also, be sure to subscribe and follow us on social media. You can email us at editor@wrti.org.
Our show is hosted by Nate Chenin and me, Josh Jackson, and produced by Alex Arif. Robbie Webb is our assistant production manager. He mixed this episode. Our production assistants are Alexander Bollacker, Jacob Dodd, Delia Joyce, and Alana Beltran.
Our director of operations and production is Tyler McClure. Associate general manager for content and programming is Josh Jackson. Bill Johnson is WRTI's general manager.
Stop by WRTI.org. Check out all the stuff we are cooking here in Philly and beyond. And we'll see you soon.